Welcome, Michael Rinkowicz. We are happy to have you with us here at Missiology Podcast. I am your host, Martin Rodriguez, and we're excited to hear a little bit about the ways that God has been shaping you as a scholar. Michael, thank you for being with us. Tell us about a little bit about where you're at and what it is that you're doing right now at this phase in your life and in your scholarship, your ministry. Where are you?
Sure. I'm in Florida. I didn't ever expect to be here, but because I retired from Asbury in 2010 from the seminary.
Okay.
And live in southern Indiana on a family farm. And I saw it as a place where my children could come to visit, and we'd still have the one place, the farm. But as they get older and get families and so on, and they're scattered, five children in four different states, they were coming home less and less. So we finally decided to move near one of them. My daughter is a professor of medical anthropology at Florida Atlantic University, which everybody heard about last year during March Madness, because they had a surprise good basketball team. And so anyway, we moved down here about a month and a half, 2 months ago, and we're still settling in, unpacking boxes and so on. And what do I do here? I had a Sunday school class in Mount Vernon, and when COVID hit, I started preparing a lesson. It's called Bible 101. All we do is Bible. And I started preparing weekly lessons and sending it to them, usually four pages, single-spaced, like this is Acts chapter 2, and so on. And then even when COVID left, I kept that up, and I added a couple of more constituencies, my brothers and sisters and in-laws and then my children. And so I really got in the groove of doing that every week, and that's, I like being forced to read the Bible. Because when I schedule things that way, then every week I just finished Exodus with them, and every week I was right there in the text and reading a commentary or two, and then adding what I know in anthropology and so on. And so I've left that behind. So one of the things I'm trying to figure out is how to set up a website and maybe still do a Sunday morning Sunday school lesson and a Wednesday devotional, and get those online. If people want them, then they can go to them. So kind of working on that.
That's a fun project. I like that. How often do we, maybe other people can't relate to this, but man, I get so caught up with all of my other reading that the Bible sometimes gets, it gets kind of set aside in all of my research and all my scholarship. I'm like, wait, I haven't been spending time in Scripture. Like, I really want to and need to, in order to keep this relationship alive that connection, that attentiveness to God's Holy Spirit around all the time. I think that's a great project. I really like hearing that. My guess is that you're incorporating some missiological insights as well as you're writing these out.
That's the thing. It forces you to, we could read the Bible and then go on with the rest of our day, and doing what I'm doing, and then drawing on, I'll be 80 years old next year, so drawing on, years.
Wow, you look great.
Experience.
Our listeners can't see you, but you look like you're in good shape.
It helps to incorporate Scripture into our lives. So anyway, that's one of the things I'm doing. I read voraciously. I just finished the Chronicle of William of Rubruck, who went to visit the Mongols, because I'd never read that book. Had it here, and I wondered what it was like. I'm currently reading Midwifery and Development in Mexico, which is an ethnography and anthropological study of midwifery, and doing that to help my daughter out, because she wants to know what I think of the book and how it's put together, because she's writing a book.
Okay.
And so helping her with that.
That's awesome.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. You know,
set that up.
it's nice to have a like a built-in consultant right here. A scholar consultant. Like your daughter has somebody that she can just reach out to and say, I'm actually in a very similar situation, right? So with my dad as well, also a missiologist, I'm able to touch base with him, and he's at Pepperdine right now, but I don't think he has as much time, perhaps, as you might at this point, since he's not quite retired, not yet, at least. But I love the fact that you're able to read a book and help coach your daughter through her writing of her first book. This is your first book, is that what you said? Yeah, fantastic.
She got her degree at Washington University in St. Louis, got her master's at University of Chicago, so she has a
Okay.
pretty good pedigree.
Fantastic.
But let me flip that just a little bit. She knows a lot more about anthropology since 1990 than I do. And so there are times when I need to consult with her, like, who is Bruno Latour?
Yeah, I don't know.
I didn't know, hadn't come across the name. And it turns out he, like Foucault, is interested in the anthropology of practice and the anthropology of institutions and how practices get instantiated within an institution. Well, that's all new to me. I mean, I started anthropology in 1963 when I was in college. My major was, it turned out to be anthropology. I went to Bethel College and had a feeling that maybe God was calling me to be a missionary, and somebody said, "Well, you ought to take some anthropology," and so I did. So anyway, we'll come back to that because I want to, with respect to contributions. But so that means my anthropology is almost a pre-World War II anthropology. Most of my teachers were, well, E. Adamson Hobel. What had made his name known in the 1930s. He was a student of Franz Boas. And Robert Spencer was a student of Alfred Kroeber. Now, you can't go, in American anthropology, you can't go back any farther than Boas and Kroeber, I mean, for big names. And so I learned that anthropology. And so I depend on my daughter to try to bring me up to snuff as well.
Yeah, that's important. My guess is that those are fantastic conversations that you get to have on a semi-regular basis, if not regular basis, with your daughter. This might be a good place to transition into our first question. So tell me about a high point as a practitioner, as a scholar, when you really felt engaged and motivated. This could be at any point in your life, but an experience that really, shaped your missiology.
Let me start with, excuse me. Let me start with what I think is an interesting story. In my part of the country, when people say, "I'll tell you an interesting story or a funny story," they say, "You tell it, and I'll tell you if it's funny or interesting." I was a missionary for 5 years in Papua New Guinea and lived in the second 4 years in the highlands in Goroka, Eastern Highlands Province, and attended the United Church, which is a daughter church of the Methodist Missionaries, Australian Methodist Missionaries, and London Missionary Society in town. And there were people from all over Papua New Guinea there. And they had two village churches, sort of up on the mountain. And once a month, I would go to walk to one of those churches or the other because I could serve communion. I'm ordained in the Methodist Church.
And
so
you had to
once
walk. I mean, these are churches that didn't have roads to them. I mean, walking is how you
yeah
got to
path
them. The
yeah
path.
just a path yeah or a rough road. If you had a four-wheel drive, you might make it, but I walked. So I'd leave about 7:30 in the morning and start walking, and it would take about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours to get there. And when you get there, or when I got there, Kaveve was the name of this village. No one was at church. Now, church was like a 12 by 12 room, and that's all. And That's intentional because they don't know when somebody's walking, when they're going to arrive, where they might run into rascals along the way, highway robbers.
Right. And that was a big problem at the time. This is something that people
it's
were
always,
concerned about.
Always a problem in Papua New Guinea.
Okay.
And so nobody's at church, of course, but word goes out when I walk in, then they say, well, somebody's here to preach. And so then people start coming in. So I stood by the gate. And in Papua New Guinea, you don't fence hogs and pigs in. You fence the people in.
Okay.
And the hogs and the pigs roam freely.
Okay.
And so
so you're fencing them out.
Every house and the church has a fence around it and a gate that you go through. So I stood by the gate and I was greeting people as they came. And a woman came through and then another woman, and she was shaking my hand. And she said something in Ilocano, which is the language of that area. I don't speak Ilocano.
Okay.
There are 835 different languages in Papua New Guinea.
That's all?
835. And then after that, you get dialects after that. So you get a lot of variation.
Yeah.
But I did speak Pidgin English.
Okay.
Not great, but passably. And I preached in Pidgin English.
Okay.
And the other woman spoke Ilocano and spoke Pidgin.
Okay.
And so the woman said something, and she translated it to me in Pidgin. She said, "Emi talking me, Emi liking hand belong you too much." She says she really likes your hand. I thought, okay, she's still shaking my hand, and now she's sort of caressing it. Then she said something else, and the woman translated it, and she said in Pidgin English, Emi like cut them all finger belong you. She would like to cut off all your fingers.
I'm so glad you're here. We have our guest speaker.
That's why, no.
Right, right. No more guest speaking for you. You ran out of fingers.
I smiled at her.
Yeah.
And this is the high point. I smiled at her. And I said, Imarite. I said, one pellet, that's all. It would be all right. You can cut just one off. And she laughed, and the woman laughed, and so on. So the high point is that I knew some of the culture of this area.
Okay.
And I knew that historically, when a beloved person died, they would cut off all their fingers, dry them out in the sun, maybe smoke over the fire. And when they're dry and they're what do you call it, preserved, then drill a hole in each finger, put a cord through it, tie it around your neck. Then you have the person that you love with you always.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Yeah, my wife is not allowed to do that with my fingers. that's a very interesting tradition. Now, I'm guessing they weren't doing this. You said historically, so they weren't doing this at this isn't something that they were still doing.
But in the recent past, you remember the highlands of Papua New Guinea were not explored in some places until the 1950s.
Okay.
And even as late as 1960.
Okay.
So it's a fresh memory.
They
do not do it now. It's fresh memory, though.
Then
let me segue to the second high point. So finally, everybody comes, 15, 20 people, inside the church, and I preach my sermon in Pidgin. And then I'm going to serve communion. I mean, that's why I'm there. Not everybody who comes can serve communion. I can.
Yeah.
And I was using the passage from Luke, you could use several passages to, and if you notice, and if you know Greek, and I started taking Greek in 1964, while I was still in college.
And I think they were actually still speaking Koine Greek at that point, right? I mean, like that was still like you're still
no, actually, at Bethel at that time they. I got you. At Bethel at that time, they had somebody or two people, Bob Mounts, one of them, Walt Wessel, the other one, teaching Koine Greek. But they had Jim Jordan, whose area was the ancient Near East, historian kind of, and he taught classical Greek. So I took classical Greek, and we read Herodotus, Xenophon, Thucydides, and so on. So I went to the Lucan passage of the Lord's Supper. And if you know Greek, then you would know that when Jesus gathers them together, he says, "With great desire, I have desired to share this Passover meal with you." And what a lot of people may not know is that the notion of desire is there in the verb, "I have desired," and it's also there in the adverb. There are two different words. With great desire, I have desired to share this meal with you. And I read it in, where's my pigeon? It's over there. My pigeon Bible. Read it.
Yeah,
and
mine's
then.
on my shelf behind me as well, you know, my pigeon. That's a translation I don't have in my library.
And so I read that and I said, "Now look at that." I said, "What happened to me on the way in?" And I told the story about the woman saying she was going to cut off my fingers. And they all laughed kind of nervously, like, "Yeah, we used to do that, but we don't do that anymore." But the point was, I said, the point was that you have the same desire that Jesus talks about here, the desire to have the person with you always. And you found a way by cutting off the fingers and making a necklace of trying to get that done. I said, the promise that we have from Jesus is that he will be with us in the bread and in the wine, and he will be with us always. So that desire to share this meal with you is something that goes on and on and on and on. And we recognize it today because when we take the Eucharist, then Jesus is with us as he promised.
Oh, I
And I
like
said,
that a lot.
"All right, everything is ready here. You'll come and share this meal."
It's
And
powerful.
I hope that a story like that would reflect not on me narrowly, but on the idea of being an anthropologist and being a missionary and what kind of contribution the two can make to each other.
I mean, I love it's challenging to do what you did, which is, you know, you're attentive to the culture, you're attentive in the moment, you recognize that she's making a gesture of affection, right? She's making a gesture of connection with you and really trying to build a relational bridge with what she's saying. So not only do you avoid getting offended, right, because you understand what's going on, not only are you not, you know, repulsed, you recognize it for what it is, you're able to make a joke about it, but then you can immediately follow it up with, you know, let's tie this into how this is helping me understand the gospel, how this is helping me understand, you know, what this Eucharist is all about. You know, in many ways, it's a thank you, right, to the folks that are in the audience right there with you. Thank you for giving me another dimension for understanding and more words, more pictures for understanding this important practice that we have as Christians.
And I wish I could say that I was always that good, but that's not true. Made mistakes as well. Hadn't learned about something, and it happened, and I missed it. You know what was going on. Another high point was that when I did my PhD field work, it was in the Marshall Islands, which are halfway between Guam and Hawaii. And the title of my dissertation is "Land Tenure Among Arno," which is an atoll there. There's 35 different atolls. Arno was the one I was on. Land tenure among Arno Marshallese. And so I wanted to study how they held rights in land, how those rights were passed on from generation one generation to another. They happened to be matrilineal, So you, for example, would be inheriting from your mother and your mother's brother,
Okay.
not from your father. All right?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Why? Your father is somebody else's mother's brother.
Yeah.
His land will
Yeah.
be going to his sister's sons,
Right.
and on and on and on like that. And just to show you
That's
that
interesting.
the military needs a little anthropology too, while I was there, I was listening to Kwajalein radio. Was only one radio station, and that was
Okay.
Kwajalein, which has a missile range on it.
Okay.
And they were that the American administration, it was still a colonial administration in 69 and 70. The American administration was trying to carry out a land survey, and they came on the radio with a guy came on with an advertisement to encourage people to participate in this cadastral survey. And here's how they did it. Fathers, you want your sons to be able to inherit your land when you die, don't you? What's the answer to that? No, absolutely not. And if that's what this survey is about,
I'm not
I'm
going to
not in.
participate. Right.
Now, the reason I talked about land was that when I got to the Melanesian Institute, which is where I worked in Goroka, Melanesian Institute was founded by the Catholics. Very soon they added Lutherans, Anglican Church, and the United Church.
Oh,
And so
wow, very
each of those
ecumenical.
churches,
Wow. Okay.
yeah, all four. So each of those four had representatives or people who served on the staff there.
Okay.
And they did two things. One, they gave cultural orientation courses to new missionaries coming in,
Okay.
month-long course, and I contributed to that. But the other thing that they did was they carried out research projects, because since they had scholars or academics usually, on issues that the churches wanted to know about. For example, if the churches want to know where are we on marriage and the family?
Okay,
You know,
yeah.
it's been 25 years now since mission work has been done. Where are we? So they did that kind of work. The problem that they were getting ready to research when I arrived was churches and land, which is land's my area.
Yeah.
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 And so the issue was that in many places, people were coming back and saying to the current priest or pastor, your ancestors, meaning the first missionaries, fool deceived us about this land, and they gave us just a little bit. I mean, it's the old colonial story.
Right.
And then they took possession of the land,
Oh man.
and we want the land back.
Oh
And
man.
so here you have this priest or Lutheran pastor from Germany who just arrived, and
Right.
somebody's at the door saying that, and
This is
he's like,
mine.
"What?" So we carried out, I directed a 4-year research project on churches and land, out of which came two books, both of them collections. I edited both of them of articles about land. So, and then I have a background as a farmer,
Okay,
because
yeah.
I early on grew up on a farm in Indiana until I was 9. Then we moved to Pittsburgh, and that was a culture shock.
Oh, I bet.
Anyway, so land has been an interest of mine, and here I go to Papua New Guinea to work at the Melanesian Institute, serve as a missionary in that respect, and it's land that they are wanting to do a research project on. Now,
Yeah.
that's a kind
Wow.
of, it's either serendipitous or the invisible hand
Yeah, right. And
of
definitely
God
eye
in
point.
that.
It's nice to show up somewhere and they're asking the kind of questions that you've been thinking about for a long
Yeah,
time.
it turned
They're
out.
asking, you're like, actually, I have some ideas that I have some ideas about that.
Well, one of the conclusions I think, or the place that I tried to bring them or to get them, was in traditional Pacific Islands cultures, reciprocity, relationships, and then reciprocity, very important. You give, you receive, you give, you receive. And you don't give and receive right away necessarily. When I was in the Marshals, I learned that. Somebody, it's always good to have a cultural advisor. And this old guy came over one day and said, if somebody gives you something and you immediately make a return gift of the equal value. Do you know what that means? This is all in Marshallese, of course.
Yeah.
I said, no. He said, it means you don't want to have a relationship with them.
Right, right. Yeah.
You've paid them off.
Right, exactly. Like, I don't owe you anything. Yeah.
The best relationships are ones that are always lopsided, one way or the other. And somebody owes just a little bit more. Then he overdoes it, and the other person owes a little bit more. That's how you keep a relationship going. I said, okay, learn something there. Secondly, in Papua New Guinea especially, they're traditionally, and some of them survive to today, were trading circles or trading areas. The best known one is probably the Kula. Have you ever heard of that? It's a it centers on the Trobriand Islands off the east coast. And I lived for a year on Misima, which is in the Kula Circle. And in the Kula Circle, necklaces go one direction and armbands go the other direction. Okay. So people trade and they get they get a well-known necklace and they show it to people. Look, I've got this necklace now. But their perception of all of that is keeping while giving away. Matter of fact, they say that phrase.
Keeping while giving away.
What that means is keeping while giving away. Now I'm hearing you here. And what that means is that, yeah, I held this necklace for a while, and I had the prestige of doing that, but now I have to pass it on. But it's still in the circle.
Oh, wow.
So one day, my sister's son, they're matrilineal too, we'll come across it again. It'll come back to him.
Wow.
So there's that feeling that this whole thing is based on relationship. And even though I've given something away, it will come back to me as long as it remains in the system.
Yeah,
now, what if a
yeah.
tourist comes and he wants to buy that shell necklace? It's out of the system.
Right, right.
That's the same way they think about land.
Right, right.
They never expected to give up land to either traders or miners or missionaries and lose the land.
Wow.
Because exchanges in the traditional culture were, now we, this exchange has made us like brothers.
Right.
We are more deeply related.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'll probably run into you again someday. And this has started it, right?
Yeah, right.
All right.
Yeah.
This exchange has made us like brothers.
Yeah.
You can use that, but it'll come back to me someday. I haven't lost it.
Right.
With respect to the land, the missionaries, the traders, and the miners are telling me I've lost the land.
Right.
It really came to a head. It was a slow growth. I mean, I knew a lot of this, but it's slowly. One day, when I was living on Misima, the health aide's husband came, and he knew I had a saw. And he asked if he could borrow the saw. I said, sure, because I occasionally would make things. And he took it, and a couple of weeks went by. And finally, a month went by, 5 or 6 weeks, and I thought, where's my saw?
I hope a tourist didn't come by and buy it.
Yeah, and purchase it. And so I went over to his house and I knocked and I said, I made up a total lie. I got a project that I'm wanting to do.
I need
where's my saw? And he said, don't worry. Our saw is hanging on the wall right here. Think about that.
Okay, all right. Well, it's a compliment to you, right? I mean, that's an incredible, it's an incredible compliment. It's inviting you into the circle. And
I mean,
that's it. Even though there's a part of me that goes, that's my saw.
If you're an American, that happens. But in fact, he was saying, we now have a relationship. You won't lose your saw. Yeah. It'll either be here or it'll be with you.
Yeah.
Now, did the missionaries do that with the land? No. My recommendation to them was not take this stuff to court and fight it in court.
Right, right.
Although they may have to because times have changed. But my recommendation was, since you acquired this land, it was given to you by a particular clan or set of clans, have you recognized that?
Mm.
Do you have a yearly feast where you stand up and say, when we came, so-and-so generously gave us access to this land, and
yeah,
it's still here, and we're giving this pig today in order to recognize that,
right,
to keep that in memory and so on?
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
they didn't do that. So I had to ask the churches, did you come for the land or did you come for the people?
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. So, and all of that, as I said, is years and years of scripture and anthropology experience and then missionary experience coming together. And I again,
wow,
say, I didn't do everything perfect. I made some mistakes.
Yeah.
But when things,
yeah,
went right like that, that's what, yeah, we're shooting for.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I like about that story and about your research in that area and really the culture is that it is so relationally oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think about how unrelational our approach to the land is, right? Our approach, I mean, as Westerners, right, as Americans, a very unrelational approach to,
oh,
stuff,
yeah,
to things. I mean, we commodify everything. And so, it becomes a commodity that can be exchanged. It becomes something that, it certainly is not something that I still think of as my own, right?
Yeah.
If I give to you, or if I, you know, if I'm lending it to you, it's, you know, I live in a house that I don't know the people who live there before me. I still get their mail. It's been like, you know, 7 years since I've lived in this home, when my wife and I purchased it, but I have no idea who they are. And you know, there's a sense of loss. I think there's that sense of isolation that we have in the West, and it's, mm-hmm, you know, it must be due in part to what is clearly a strength in their culture,
yeah,
right? That lack of it must be due in part to this lack of relationality and a relational approach to stuff, right? The people come first. Relationships matter more. The circle, mm-hmm, of, you know, our social circle matters more. I mean, I love the idea that, you know, it's still within the circle, and so there's a sense in which it's not a loss, right?
No.
I may not see it for a while, or maybe my grandchildren that see it, but it's not a loss. I mean, it just reminds me so much of also the, like, year of Jubilee, right? There's,
yeah,
this,
well,
is
exactly.
There are some connections here that
I teach and preach
relevant
a lot on Leviticus 25.
Yeah.
And not only that, something like that gives me an insight on 2 Corinthians 8, where Paul is trying to take up a collection, and he's trying to encourage the Corinthian church to have this collection ready. And he says, you know, these other churches had the collection ready when I got there. It would look bad if you didn't have this collection ready.
Right, right. Don't let the Macedonians make you look bad.
Yeah, that's right. And then he tries to explain how much, why they should do this and how much. For you know the generous act of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich.
Hmm.
Now, if you know about the importance of exchange, Native American cultures, also in Pacific Islands cultures. I won't speak any further than that. Notice that there's an exchange there. Christ, though he was rich, for your sake became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. And then he says that I advise you to finish what you began, to shorten it up. For if the eagerness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. I do not mean that there should be relief for others and pressure on you. It is a question of a fair balance. Now, this is the NRSV, translates that Greek word as fair balance. Some other translations translate it as equality.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer the fair balance because equality sounds like we're trying to get it. Remember what I said about if you have exchanges and they're equal?
Right.
Equality is trying to get them exactly the same, but it cuts off the relationship. But here he says, but it's a question of a fair balance between your present abundance and their need. And this is the part I didn't understand for a long time. So that their abundance may be for your need. In order that there may be a fair balance, same Greek word. And I kept thinking, what in the world? I mean, we're talking about giving to the poor here. What does he mean?
Yeah.
Abundance. What abundance? But I found elsewhere in Scripture, and I can't put my finger on it right now, some talk about the blessing that you receive from the poor when you give to the poor. And that's kind of an exchange that's going on. At any rate, then he says, and here's where Exodus comes in, as it is written, the one who had much did not have too much, and the one who had little did not have too little. Well, that comes from God's instructions through Moses when manna first showed up, and he told them not to collect more than they would need for that day.
Right.
Because it would go bad, right? And then it also says that when people collected, it turned out when they walked back to their tent that they had just enough for the day. But listen to this. We tend to talk about giving as 10%, which means 90% is mine, right? 10% is God. Well, here's another measure that has nothing to do with percentages. And it also fits any kind of society, a hunter and gatherer society or our society. The one who had much did not have too much. So it forces us to ask, in our society, what would be somebody having too much? Do we have that? Or do we just celebrate it, or do we envy it and try to get there? And the one who had little did not have too little. In our society, what's too little? Now, in the hunters and gatherers society, having a cell phone and a car is extravagant. In our society, you can't get to work and you can't make your appointments if you don't have a cell phone and a car. So it forces us to look at society and to make that decision. Are there people here who have too much, and are there people who have too little in terms of the way we live and what we live in? I mean, that's the
original call for anthropology, right? That's the original, that we need anthropologists. That even Scripture says, right? We need people that can look and ask, what is too much, right? What is too little for us here in this context? Right. It's for someone to stand back and ask the questions, you know, what's going on with this wealth among us, and how are we thinking about this this wealth? Right. Are we thinking about this and like, has the cross of Christ reshaped and reoriented our conception of this wealth, of this the stuff that we have? And I love this passage where he starts with, and by the way, Jesus gave you everything, right? So we've been brought into a circle that's pretty awesome, and it reorients, you know, what is ours and yours, and how I think about generosity.
And the thinking about relationality and exchange, reciprocal exchange, when you bring that to the Bible, it helps you with your hermeneutics, your interpretation.
Oh, I like that. You know, one of the things that that I like about this whole conversation so far, in missionary anthropology, you know, missionary anthropologists got a bad rap for quite a while there. I mean, you know, in the wake in the wake of the colonies and the, you know, modern colonialism, the collapse of that, the empires, and certainly you have a lot of people that are criticizing missionaries as, you know, you guys are just, you're meddling, you know, you're coming up, you're just trying to figure out ways to, you know, like press your beliefs onto these other cultures. And, you know, so you're using anthropology as a stepping stone for your agenda, right? This is just your way of like analyzing the culture so that you can make your missionaries more effective. So part of what I love about this conversation is that you're reorienting us to what a missionary anthropologist does is, in many ways, like you're learning from this culture about your own culture, right? And you're reflecting back on, so mm-hmm. how does the gospel, how am I seeing the gospel in new ways because of my exposure to the other? How am I seeing and understanding the gospel in new ways? And then how can I, you know, how can I bless my own people, mm-hmm. right? How can I help teach my own people? So it's not just, you know, it's not I don't have an agenda for them over there, even though, of course, we do. Thanks to God, we really do want to involve them in our circle, right? We want yep. them in our circle as well. But so much of the benefit of missionary anthropology is to the missionary's own culture, right? It's so much of the blessing is you coming back and being able to write these Bible studies, right? These you know, for your congregation, your circle.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. The issue is whether or not the missionary is humble enough to learn.
Mm.
And to learn from mistakes.
Yeah.
And then, and to discover what is good in the other culture. I mean, it's, you know, if you go back 200 years, there's so much of, you know, this yeah. whole culture is bad and it needs to be replaced and so on.
Right.
E. Stanley Jones did that with India, you know, in the 1910s and the 1920s. That's why he's famous for Christ of the Indian Road. Mm-hmm. And so on,
yeah.
and that is that you realize. Well, let me just say that I preached occasionally. I didn't preach every Sunday there because there was a pastor in the church. But when I did, I didn't have to preach the same sermons in Papua New Guinea that I would preach in the States,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Because they already did some things that were very Christian.
Right.
And then they did some things that weren't.
Yeah.
But those things were different than the things that problems we have in our culture.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we might have a chance to circle back to some of these themes. Let me ask you about primary relationships that have really contributed to your research and ministry. Can you name one or two of those?
I can go way back when I got to Bethel. There was an anthropologist named Claude Stipe, who's long gone, and he was just an excellent, excellent teacher. And the next year, a man named Tom Correll, who had been a missionary to the Inuit, missionary linguist, and both of them were just so full of stories and insights. And both of them very encouraging for me. Mm-hmm. And so when I finally reached the end of my college career, I thought about what to do. And I thought, you know, they did such a good job, helped us in so many ways, that I wonder if God doesn't need Christian anthropologists as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I applied to the University of Minnesota, got in, and did my master's and my PhD there.
Yeah.
So they were.
Any other relationships? So you went back 60 years for us. Are there other things that you would say, even more recently, have been important relationships that have really contributed to your research and ministry?
When I was in Papua New Guinea, as I said, that the institute that I worked for was Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, and Methodist, or United Church. And I really learned how to work with the Roman Catholics in particular. The Catholics were all of a society called the Society of the Divine Word, called SVDs, Societas Divinitas Verba.
Mm-hmm.
And they're an interesting group. They were founded when, in the Kulturkampf, the culture wars that Bismarck brought on Germany in the 1870s and 1880s. The south of Germany, he was unifying Germany, but the south of Germany was Catholic. Of course, Bismarck's Protestant northern Germany. And he shut down all the seminaries. And some of the priests went to the Netherlands and started a group called the SVDs and started a seminary there in order to be able to send priests back into Germany. And it strikes me that maybe why the reason they're so culturally sensitive now, and I mean they were a missionary order, missionaries in China, missionaries in Papua New Guinea, various places in Africa, India. Maybe that came upon them because they themselves were victims of a culture on the negative side of a culture war.
Maybe that's kind of stuck with their DNA. I think about, you know, today I think of people like I think Stephen Bevins and Roger Schroeder. I think both of them belong to the Society of the Divine Word. Is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean. How much of that original DNA, you wonder, how much of that original, of being on the losing side, right? Mm-hmm. How much of that has stuck with that, you know, that the culture that they've developed in that society? I mean, because you can see how that would, it would shape, it would help people think about themselves and their context differently. But you were about to say something. I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you about to say?
Oh, that you're right. It developed a good relationship, so much so that in, I think, 2004, I was invited to go to Poland to give a seminar on how to re-evangelize Europe, postmodern Europe. So a seminar on postmodernity. Yeah. And that was a great experience. And then Roger Schroeder, about 3 years ago, contacted me, and they were doing a 100-year anniversary of the SVDs. People were writing various articles, and he invited me to write the concluding article, which was a view from the outside of what the SVDs, and I took that as a great honor. Yeah. And then he also invited me at a different time to give the Luzbatek lectures, which are a famous set of lectures.
Yeah.
So
And that was more recent. I think that was in 2019, wasn't that?
Yes.
When you gave the lectures?
Yeah. I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it just gives you a different perspective. I mean, our own history here has been pretty violent in relationships between Protestants and Catholics. If you read a book like The Guarded Gate, which is a book about immigration and the immigration laws around 1880 to 1920 in that area. And there's some really vile things going on with respect to Catholic immigration and Catholics and not getting more Catholics in here. I remember this one cartoon that was a political cartoon written at the time, which had a bunch of men in the water coming ashore, and they all had miter hats on, but the hatch opened up and made them look like crocodiles.
Oh.
So here the Catholics are crocodiles who are coming ashore to destroy us.
Yeah.
And, So, I don't know, the mission field for me was, I mean, I wasn't hostile to begin with, but the mission field was good for learning to get along with other missionaries, most other missionaries.
Yeah.
Some really conservative, and I won't name them, missionaries were just not very friendly to anybody.
I wonder about that kind of, you know, that liminal space that societies like that they have to dwell in. They have to kind of, you know, they're learning, they're developing in the midst of all of that, you know. And I think about the way that there's, I wonder if there's not an analogy to people who are people like myself, for instance, who grew up in a family that has multiple cultures that are a part of it. You know, I my dad's side, Roman Catholic, my mom's side of the family, Lutheran and a Restoration Movement, Church of Christ. And, you know, it, and really, my parents really had to navigate that space, and of course I'm born into that, those conversations. It's also between German and Mexican American, and German American and Mexican American. I mean, it's all of the, all of that is, I think they, it does help develop a kind of sensitivity, maybe a mm-hmm. little bit more humility, a little bit more of that. I don't know if it's more humility, but not, we don't have to be comparative, but that sensitivity to difference, and to recognizing difference, and recognizing that difference need not be a barrier to relationship.
Right? Yeah. Because that, certainly that's, wasn't for Jesus.
Right. So praise God that it was.
Yeah.
Yes.
I call that, by the way, epistemological humility. So yeah. Humility yeah. about how we know things and how much I think I know.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, I'm just constantly reminded that. That I don't. And the thing that you're talking about, the third culture kid, mm-hmm. Is interesting. I see in my, I have two families. I have two older children, mm-hmm. and my first wife died in 1986 mm-hmm. of breast cancer. And then I married again, and we have three children. Mm-hmm. Well, the younger three went to Papua New Guinea and grew up in Papua New Guinea.
Okay.
And one of them is this professor at FAU right now.
Okay.
And okay. So, yeah, the third culture kids, I just directed a student. He's he's 50-something and been a missionary for a long time. But he grew up in Panama, I think.
Okay.
And lives in Spain now.
Okay.
And he now runs camps for third culture kids, okay. summer camps, and you know, to help them through the issues, yeah. identify with that.
Right.
And I think, by the way, that was influential for me getting into anthropology, because I lived in Indiana on the farm until I was 9 years old. In 1953, my dad's job took him back to Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. where he was from.
Okay.
And we moved to Pittsburgh. So I went to junior high and high school in Pittsburgh. And as I said, that was quite a culture shock, both in language.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like English, but it's a variation. both in language and in... But at any rate, then when I graduated from high school in 62, then I went to Minnesota.
Okay.
I'd never been to Minnesota before. I went to Bethel partly to play football there. But all the other people on the team were Nelsons and Olsons and Johansons and Bjorklunds and so mm-hmm. on and so on. And I learned after I got there that 5 years before, the Baptist General Conference had been called the Swedish Baptist Conference.
Oh.
So it was another culture shock for me, and I yeah. really had to adapt. I mean, they'll say, going downtown, you want to come with?
Yeah.
You keep waiting. It's not going to happen. Not going to happen. And so I think when I started to take anthropology, I started to think, oh, it's not me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not mm-hmm. just me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you move from one area of the country to another, or from one country to another,
yeah.
this is the way things are.
Yeah.
And it'll take some learning and some listening to negotiate
yeah.
all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife describes moving to L.A. She's from Montana, mostly Scottish and Irish in her background, but she describes moving to L.A. as more challenging culturally than when we moved to China.
Wow.
So for her, the adjustment to Chinese relationships and culture, and it was easier for her than, obviously, things like language was more difficult in China. But I mean, I take her at her word. Like, what, you know, part mm-hmm. of it has to do with expectations, certainly. And yet, you know, we're talking about the United States, and this is a large country with a lot of different kinds of people, and even the shift from rural to urban is a dramatic change, regardless of what state you live in, right? Mm-hmm. That is a it's a significant difference. So when we talk about pluralism, when we talk about multiculturalism, right, it doesn't have to be, you know, a Rodriguez, you know, Rinkovich or Rinkovich, like, you know, difference. It doesn't have to be color of the skin. I mean, we're also talking, you know, let's talk about zip codes. Let's talk about socioeconomic level. Mm-hmm. You know, let's talk about all these. So, so one of the things that your training has done for you is, and one of the ways that, you know, maybe this even contributes to this this other question, but it's really helped open your eyes to these differences, to notice them, and then to help teach others, right? To help to invite others into your this missional imagination, this way of seeing the world and interacting with people, that notices difference and then doesn't run. it's not trying to get away, but recognizing it and still leaning in.
Yeah. The most recent book, by the way, and I just read it a couple of months ago, argues that there are 11 nations in Canada, the United States, and Mexico, parts of Mexico, but all 11 are in the United States.
Right.
And have to do with migration from the east heading toward the west and where they went and and so on. It's believable.
Can you describe a time that you recognized that God was shaping you as a scholar? Tell us about it.
As a scholar.
As a scholar, as a disciple, you know, we're thinking about a time when you recognize God's agency in your life. And maybe there have been a lot, many different times, but one that stands out for you in your mind.
Well, in part, the journey. I mean, I started out with training as an anthropologist, taught anthropology for 10 years at McAllister College in St. Paul. And then I kept having this nagging feeling that maybe God had something else in mind. And when I was in college, I remember reading a tract by A.W. Tozer, where he argued that God's will for your life might not be one thing. It might be a succession of things, which is a good reminder to stay in touch. You know, if God says, go do this, and you say, all right, I got it, and you're gone. Maybe this was a stepping stone to something else, and then that was a stepping stone to something else. And I kind of see it, not to say that I made every decision and every turn, right turn, in my life. But I went back to Indiana, and there were no jobs in, no anthropology departments down in southern Indiana other than IU, but that wasn't where I was going. And so I got a job as a grain merchandiser at working at a grain elevator on the river. And because I had a farm background in part. And the anthropology came in very helpful because, you know, when I walked through the door, one guy said, you know, if these rivers freeze up north, the Board of Trade is going to go sky high and SIFNOLA will go through the roof. Now, that's English. Did you understand it? Right. It was a matter of treating that business like a different language and a different culture.
Right.
SIFNOLA is Cargo Insurance and Freight at New Orleans, Louisiana, CIFNOLA.
So I almost had it. I was close.
So it's the price you could get for corn that day.
Right.
Delivered in a barge to New Orleans. And then Chicago Board of Trade, I mean, the Board of Trade is in Chicago where they trade futures. You have to learn what futures are and so on. And so the anthropology came in very helpful. In, as I said, 1986, May of 86, my first wife died, 38 years old. And that was, of course, a very... very tense time, and I sensed God's hand all the way through that. both for her and for me and for my two older children. Mm-hmm. But 2 months after she died, the district superintendent called and said, I have a small church that lost their pastor, and they've asked if you could be their pastor. Because I had been doing, on Sunday morning, substitute preaching if a Methodist minister was on vacation or something like that.
Right.
So I prayed about it overnight, and I took that church on. And I pastored there for 10 years. That was in 1986, starting in the fall of 86. 1990, the same district superintendent called and said, I know you want to go to seminary. How about if I give you another church? You sell your house and quit your job. I'll give you another church and a parsonage. And from that base, you can go to seminary. Hmm. Again, prayed about it overnight. In the morning, I said, yep, I'll do that.
Yeah.
It's, I think I have this faith enough in God not to, if I can see it's the right direction to go, I don't mind leaving everything behind and doing it, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't get paid much in a little country church. And I now had the two kids and a third kid.
Yeah.
And two more were coming that I didn't know. So I went to Asbury for 2 years and got my MDiv. Of course, I already had my PhD, so it wasn't that hard.
Yeah.
And I had these two churches. Then the opportunity came to, in 96, that the General Board of Global Ministries was willing to send us to Papua New Guinea.
Mm.
Well, that's in the Pacific Islands, and where is my PhD research?
Mm.
Pacific Islands.
Yeah.
And on land, and it turned out we already went through that, about land being important when I got there.
Yeah.
Or being the question that they had, and I happen to know a lot about how to get the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And then in 2002, we were thinking about coming home after 5 years, and Tom Correll up at Bethel wanted me to come to Bethel Seminary to teach there, to be a professor of mission. And Darrell Whiteman at Asbury had emailed me about something, and then I said something about Bethel, and he said, oh, wait, he said, we want you to come here. And so I ended up coming back to the States and interviewing in both places.
Mm.
Interviewed at Bethel, got on the plane, went down to Asbury, interviewed, and then went back to Papua New Guinea. And that went back and forth, but I won't tell the long story, but ended up at Asbury then and teaching the mission. And I feel like it was the right place and the right time for me. And I felt like I had really, with all the anthropology background and with the missionary background now, felt like I had something to offer.
Hmm.
And so eventually I was the director of postgraduate studies, meaning in charge of all the doctoral programs there. And I had a good run, but 2010, when I was 65, decided to, it was time to retire.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, as I look back at all that, you know the old story about tapestry, that, you know, God is weaving a tapestry of our lives. We see it from the bottom.
Yeah.
It looks ragged. And he sees it from the top. And it looks beautiful. So I trust that that's what's happening.
Mm.
Through the good and the bad.
That's powerful. Thank you. As you think about your own writing, your presentation, what do you think are the most valuable ways that you contribute to theory and practice in missiology, the theory and practice of missiology?
Yeah. So I taught anthropology from 71 to 81. Then 81 to 91, I was in business. So I was a little bit out of touch. And then in 96, spring of 97, actually, whenever it was realizing I was going back to an anthropological field, in a sense, started reading to catch up on anthropology. And I read a book by Bruce Knopft, who's at Emory University, that was really about what we would call postmodern anthropology.
Hmm.
So it turned out in the time that I was gone from 81 to 96, anthropology had made tremendous turns upside down. We were concerned about, well, when you read ethnographies before that time, you barely saw the anthropologist in the ethnography.
Okay.
I remember Evans Pritchard's The New Era, which is one of the classic ethnographies. In the prologue, he talks about some of the difficulties he had in the field. Like, he would ask people questions, and then they would ask him a question back and keep playing around, so he would never get the answer to the question that he wanted. Of course, he was there under British colonialism. In the late 30s. And the British were at odds with the New Era because they were sort of they were rebellious and independent and so on. But the rest of the ethnography, he doesn't show up in there at all. And in that period, 81 to 96, those 15 years, really became important for the anthropologist to identify herself or himself because of what we call viewpoint perspective. You know, it's not a, just because the anthropologist is there, it's not a God's eye perspective on what's going on. The anthropologist is actually there as the sort of the instrument of research, but then you got to pay attention to how's the instrument been calibrated. And we weren't admitting that that was the case. Then we get something like Malinowski's diaries of him in the field, and it really adds a completely different story to Bronislaw Malinowski, the Argonauts of the Western Pacific. Yeah, but what about him? How'd he get this information? How to get along with the people, and so on and so on. So that had changed, certainly. The whole issue of that anthropology, as you said, and mission work, at least recent mission work, all grew up in colonialism, and sometimes could be seen in service to colonialism. All that had to be handled. Then there was the issue, and it actually goes back a little farther. Back in the 1930s, Robert Loy, I remember writing an ethnography on the Crow, said, the Crow do such and such. Then he had a footnote to that, and he says, Two Crows, did a guy's name, Two Crows, denies that this happened, that's the way it is. And I always wondered about that. Like, you mean culture isn't monolithic? You mean that people disagree, that they're contesting each other's? What people are saying? That, and then the third thing, or an additional thing, is we're the women. It turned out a lot of our ethnographies are the ethnography of New Era men. Because it was a man, Evans Pritchard, who did the research. And now more and more in the 80s and 90s, more and more women coming in. Well, Margaret Mead to begin with, but and Ruth Benedict, but more and more women coming into anthropology. So there are all these questions and gaps about what anthropology is about that had changed from the 80s through the 90s. And then I start to become a missiologist. And even by 2002, it seemed to me, and this is it will be offensive, I'm sure, to some established missiologists. It seems to me they were still teaching in 1960s anthropology for use in mission. That it came to a point in the road, and anthropology went like this, and missiology went like this. Missiology held on to the old things, the old way of looking at the world. So I've seen my role as trying to bring missiologists, especially with non-anthropological missiologists, but bring them up to snuff with respect to what anthropology is about and how it can contribute to mission. So, for example, the title of my 2011 textbook, a postmodern anthropology for a mission in a post-colonial world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the subtitle, Soul, yeah. Self, and Society. And then that. Yeah. One of my articles in Missiology. Well, the first article I published in Missiology is titled Person in Mission. And, no, I'm sorry. The first article I did in Missiology is The World in My Parish. John Wesley's famous for having said, the world is my parish.
Right, right.
But I was talking about the amount of circulation of people and circulation of goods. When I was on Missima, which is off the coast of Papua New Guinea, I started documenting everything that I saw there. And I thought, where'd this come from? Came from India, came from England, it came from Fiji, it came from Australia, it came from the United States. I mean, somebody at church has got a Benny Hinn tape.
Yeah.
So, what? And then I go to the post office and bring back mail for the church. And here's a Word of Life, or Word of Faith, rather, magazine from Oklahoma,
yeah.
From Tulsa.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how's all this stuff get here?
Yeah.
So Person in Mission was that. That was to counter the notion that we deal with cultures, and cultures are spheres, and everything inside the culture is the same, but stuff from outside culture rarely, that culture rarely gets there.
Yeah.
That's not true. It's never been true.
Right.
Never been true of the world. I mean, we read William of Rubruck, and he keeps running into all kinds of people on his way to meet with the Great Khan. I mean, Germans and people from India, all that in Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the 1200s.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Read a book called The Bay of Bengal. That's a subtitle. And in that book, he tries to talk about all the trade that happens from India over to Singapore. In the whole Bay of Bengal, and it was happening in the 500s and the 600s and the 700s and so on.
Yeah.
It's never been that way.
Yeah.
So we should never have thought of it, unless we find the most isolated people in the world.
Yeah.
And it's not certainly not that way now.
Yeah.
And then my second article was Person in Mission, and my question there for missionaries is, who do you think you're talking to?
Mm.
You yourself just said that you are at least two different cultures and maybe three.
Mm-hmm.
Many places in the world, somebody gets up in the morning and they are Malay and have a Malay breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go off to work and they're speaking another language, maybe English.
Mm-hmm.
And then after work, they stop off somewhere and they're speaking another language with some friends. They're speaking and so on and so on. Most of the world is like that.
Yeah.
And so that's what I meant about person and mission. Who do you think, how's this person put together?
Yeah.
And, you know, we tend to think, you know, body, soul, and spirit, or maybe just body and soul, or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, every culture has a notion of how persons are put together, and they're not the same.
Yeah.
And it makes a big difference in whether they can react. And then my third article was a critique of missionary slogans pretending to be a strategy for mission, like the 1040 window.
Right, yeah.
Have you seen that article?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just the more I looked at that, the more I thought, what?
Yeah.
You know, the biggest Asian Christian country, Philippines, is in the 1040 window. And the biggest Asian non-Christian country,
yeah.
Indonesia, is outside of the 1040 window. And then I would run into missionaries whose support had been cut by churches because they weren't in the 1040 window.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And that's when a slogan does damage.
Yeah. So here's a question for you, because I have a lot of things that I wonder about with regard to, you know, this... this taking two paths, right? This divergence between, anthropology post 80s, right? Anthropology that demonstrates more reflexivity, that is attentive to power issues, attentive to gender issues, that is, you know, it's attentive to pluralism. You know, the cultures are not monolithic. They have fuzzy borders. You know, people have plurality even within their own consciousness, right? There is a plurality. You were describing the Malay person who's, so you have that, those conversations so important within anthropology. We could call it secular anthropology, and missiology. It feels like it diverges, you know, so we're kind of stuck. I think you said in the 60s, is that what you said? Like we're still.
Yeah.
So how would you answer this question? Why did that happen?
Why does that happen?
Yeah, why did that happen? Like what, why is that? Why that divergence?
I've got an answer that I don't know if it's true or not. It again, may be kind of offensive. I think it happens because conservative Christians themselves grow up in a bubble. And when they run into somebody teaching anthropology for mission in the old style, that's radical to them. It's brand new to them.
The whole idea they think about culture in general, just like thinking about culture and contextualization, all of that is just it's new enough in and of itself.
And so it's been successful, and it continues to be successful because of the audience. But I wonder how long that's going to last. Or even conservative Christians born since 2000, are they that much in a bubble that they'll think that that's, oh, this is new? I don't think so. And I think, you know, sooner or later, we've got to catch up with the times.
I like that. Any other reasons that you would say, look, here are some reasons why we have this divergence in this field, you know, that we shouldn't have this divergence, right? I mean, missiologists, if anybody, should be the ones that are really attentive to cutting edge research on culture and on, you know, societies and on humans. Yeah.
I wonder, another thing that bothers me, and it may help explain it in part, is that I am seeing fewer and fewer anthropologists who have a PhD from a secular university working in seminaries, Bible colleges and seminaries. Trinity, for a while, didn't have one after Bob Priest left. Manuel Rockels is there, and I know him, and he is a good anthropologist, a German. I don't think that Fuller has an anthropologist with a secular PhD. Asbury had Daryl and then me, and we're both gone from there. Still have Sue Russell and Steve Iberola, but both of them are getting old enough to retire, and I don't see a young anthropologist there. And so I wonder if it's because that this, our generation of anthropologists taught a generation that is now teaching, but they're not anthropologists. They didn't have to go to Dartmouth and deal with where anthropology is now, and learn about where anthropology is now, and then turn around. They were taught by an older generation like mine that did most of their teaching was under the old paradigm. So it's another reason why it possibly. There's something about hybridity. And I'm not talking about the social kind. I'll use corn and soybeans as an example. And there's something called hybrid vigor. When you take two varieties of corn and you put them together, that first generation is usually very strong. But if you just keep crossing that with itself, it gets weaker and weaker.
Okay.
It dilutes out, and we don't need to go into the genetics of it,
yeah,
but it dilutes out some of the strength that it had. And I wonder if that's true in academia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That we're losing some of that hybrid vigor, bringing somebody who had to go through the system and be, a certified anthropologist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then comes to bring that to bear on mission issues.
Yeah.
Hey friends, Greg here. Just a note on where to find more about Michael and his work. You can go to his website, MichaelARinkowicz.com. I'm going to spell that for you because the last name is tricky. MichaelARinkowicz.com. MichaelARinkowicz.com for more of his work. All right, let's get back to it.
Part of it.
Yeah. If you had... So if you had two or three wishes about the shaping of missiology over the next decade or two, what are your hopes? What are your wishes for the changing shape of this, of our field of study?
For shaping missiology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would like for us to be more careful in teaching missiology. People with getting masters and getting PhDs with the issue of research. Mm. I want to draw a distinction between teaching content and teaching method. Mm. By that I mean, so you grew up in a village or a REO, I don't know, in
yeah.
Mexico,
uh-huh.
right?
Yes.
When were you last there?
Oh man, it's been too long. It was pre COVID that I was there.
Okay.
Yeah, but right.
Well, not more than 5 or 6 years then.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now it's possible for somebody or for your department to say, we would like you to teach about Central Mexican culture.
Mm.
And you might say, I spent many, many years down there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you teach a class, and the people take down all the content. Don't say this, say that. Don't do this to somebody. Don't shake a hand this way. So and so on. You got all that down.
Yeah.
But they go down there themselves. Then they're sent to the same village.
Mm.
Now think about it. Mm. Are they prepared to handle that? Yeah, that's my answer too.
Yeah.
Now, here's
things
the alternative.
Things are just changing so fast. I mean, I think it's just that it's yeah. messy and complex, and it's getting messier and more complex at a faster rate, it feels like. Or maybe we're just more attentive to it now, that more aware, we're more aware of it at a faster rate.
Yeah. And there were people, you know, and some that you depended on, some that you didn't trust, and so on. But that panel of people is not the same panel of people that she ran into when she went down there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the ones that she developed that I could trust this one, but I can't trust that one, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
Now, here's the alternative. What if you teach her how to learn that stuff, how to do ethnography, mm-hmm. how to learn that stuff herself?
Mm-hmm.
How do you enter the culture? How do you make friends? How do you collect information? And then how do you systematically, once you get the language down and so on, how do you systematically take a look at the structure of society and ask questions and get an idea of who's over here and who's over there and so on?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, she does that, is successful for 10 years there. And then her mission agency says, you're doing such a good job there, we think you ought to go to China.
Hmm.
Now, does she have to go to remedial classes on Chinese culture?
Mm-mm.
Or is she already equipped
to
make her own way in a new village or suburb or whatever it is?
Yeah, yeah.
So my point is, whatever we know, whatever I know about the Pacific Islands is outdated. I was last there in 2014 in Ukarumpa, the SIL Wycliffe thing where I was giving some lectures. That's 10 years ago. So one, I'm too far removed from it to give reliable information. Two, the person will not run into the same incidents, the same problems, the same people that I did. And three, they're going to have to develop their own way of making friends, getting groups to circulate in, and so on and so on. Now, why aren't we teaching them that?
That's good. So you would, a way of summarizing this, I think you mentioned, so a greater emphasis on method and maybe using content as examples, but not for teaching method, but not focusing on content. Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In other words, I'm going to give you some examples. Don't expect to run exactly into this example, but give you an example of a cultural issue and how people, how different missionaries have handled that issue and so on.
Yeah.
But when you get there, you'll have to find out for yourself. Maybe along that line where they're at, or other things that come up.
Yeah.
I mean, think of Ukraine, think of Palestine. You could go all the way around the world.
Yeah.
You know, how do you prepare people to go into a rapidly changing world?
Yeah.
And changing on many levels. I mean, the whole internet media thing.
I got to be in China right at 2003, and so that's when I moved there. And that, from 2003 to 2004, cell phones were introduced in the area where I was living. So the rich people had them previously, but as far as, you know, broad service and easier access, it was really during that time. So I watched everyone, as soon as they could, go out and buy cell phones. And in when I had moved there in 2003, there were very, very few people who dressed like me in blue jeans. Right, so wearing tennis shoes and blue jeans and a t-shirt. Only 2 years later, I mean, the dress had changed completely. I mean, people were wearing different clothes. It was exposure to the West. It was exposure to different styles. It was, and you could see, you could feel the changes happening so quickly. You know, and maybe for me it was a little bit more apparent because I was an outsider. And I'm coming in and I'm just watching some of the things that are just maybe surface level changes. But man, as far as the speeding up of that change, yeah, you certainly can see that in places like China.
And that also relates to our prejudices about what a Native American ought to look like, what an Indian ought to look like. You know, like, where's your feathers? Put on your regalia and so
on.
And so we have a tendency to think, we change. But there's some people here that I don't want them to change. I want them to be always in my image. And so in China, that may have happened to you. Like, I got used to the old dress, and I like that. It's really authentic. There's what's probably a terrible word. And then they start changing, and you say, well, they aren't authentic anymore.
Wait
a minute. They're not allowed to change? But they aren't.
Which
brings up the whole issue of contextualization, by the way, which is another, you know, always a big topic. And my question is, contextualization to what? Contextualization to the way this culture was 30 years ago? And then contextualization by whom? And, you know, Hebert points out that you need a local group of Christians really to be in charge of contextualization. I had a student once who, see if I get this right. He was trying to look at contextualization in, it was either India or Bangladesh village, to get my memories right. And he had been learning about contextualization, so he wanted to try that. So when he came back, he had an interesting story. He said, I tried to figure some ways to do text contextualization. I made some suggestions to them. They didn't seem to like it very much, the committee in the church.
Yeah.
And finally, the church committee realized that there was a practice, a Buddhist practice, or Hindu practice, of, in the weekends, going to a village, taking a team to a village, and singing, and doing some plays, and so on, and to sort of spread the message of Hinduism, or reinforce it. And they said, why don't we do that? Mm-hmm. Why don't we do village or weekend trips, and we'll sing Christian songs, and we'll give a Christian play, showing maybe the birth of Christ, or maybe the crucifixion, or the teachings, and so on. Mm-hmm. But what he came back saying was, they listened politely to what I had to say, and then they figured out what to do, and they went and did it. And so he realized that he was not in a position to do the contextualization.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that if you had committed Christians who were led by the Spirit, they could do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that. How would you state that as a wish? With you know, that you're describing a shift in perspective on contextualization. What would that look like? If how would you articulate that as a wish? You know, going forward in the next decade or two, with regard to mission theology and the way it continues to you know, be reshaped. How would you state that as a wish? Like, what would be the wish with regard to contextualization?
I would hope that we would constantly rethink contextualization. That we would teach people how to, if they're Western missionaries, teach them how to be contextualization guides, without being the actual people who do the contextualization. They would help the local church carry that out.
That's good. Michael, thank you. This has been fantastic. I appreciate this conversation and the stories that you've been telling. On behalf of Missiology Podcast and Missiology.com, I want to say thank you for being very generous with your time with us. I think you've sparked for many, me certainly, and many of us that are listening, you've sparked some really good questions. You've brought up important issues that really missiology does need to be thinking about, and I appreciate the way that you've lived out some of those questions as well, right? You've lived out, what does it look like to wrestle with these? So thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. And
my pleasure, Martin. I thank you. It's been very engaging.
Thank you.
Which I appreciate. Yeah.
Thank you. You know, at some point we'll have to have you back on to talk more about some of these topics that you brought up here later on. Including contextualization, I think, you know, for some future conversations, we could have a lot of fun, you know, hearing from you and getting perspectives, hearing you bring up those good questions for those of us who are in the midst of all of these kinds of conversations. So, thank you. I you know, with deepest gratitude, I want to say we'll see you next time.